Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So we wake to the news of the death of Stephen Sondheim. I'm saying, Mark, that's the way to go. Do you know the details? 91 years old.
Died at home.
91. Died at home. 4 days ago, he'd given an interview to the New York Times. Celebratory interview. You know, if ever a man, you know, lived to see his lap of honor many times, it was Stephen Sondheim. Gave an interview to the New York Times, came into New York to be there at the opening of another revival of his 70s musical company, and also to go to two other plays. He was kind of clapped around Broadway pretty much all the way.
And this was just before he died, wasn't it?
Just before he died. Yeah, a couple of days or whatever. And they're looking forward to there's a new revival of West Side Story film coming soon. Just absolutely extraordinary. 91 years old. What an innings. What an extraordinary
really
body
is
of work.
Taking a final bow, isn't it? Final.
Comment. It really is. And I was thinking about, do you remember when we had Andy Miller as our guest on Word in Your Ear, and when they were picking out the greatest music books?
Yeah.
And Andy suggested one that was completely new to me, which is Finishing the Hat by Stephen Sondheim, and I actually went and looked it out in the library. It's an absolutely extraordinary large format book, which is a memoir of all of his career. But it's also chock full of fantastic craft advice for songwriters. And Sondheim, nobody thought more, it seems to me, than Sondheim about the business of putting words together with music. You know, that it wasn't just a question of doing good words and doing good music. It was a question of how you locked them together. And one of his quotes is that there's a big difference between poetry and lyrics, is that lyrics should sort of fade into the background. They fade on the page and they live on the stage. And because it's all about the music, it's all about how you put the two
wonderful
together. And he said one of his earliest successes was, of course, he wrote the lyrics for West Side Story. And probably, arguably, the best-known song from West Side Story is Somewhere. But throughout his life, he always used to regret the fact that if you listen to the first line of Somewhere, it's just, there's a place for us. And he says, I've put all the emphasis and the highest note on the least important word in the
word.
Line.
The
word A. Right. And it used to vex him absolutely all the time. And he said, you don't get a chance to hear a lyric twice. And if it doesn't sit and bounce when the music bounces and rise when the music rises, the audience become confused. And that's so true, because, you know, his songs were quite complicated ideas. And so you had to hear them perfectly the first time. Otherwise, you simply wouldn't get the idea at all. And absolutely, absolutely extraordinary person. He also said, art is all about craft, not inspiration. And that's a true fact. It's all about, you know, how you keep on doing it, how you keep on trying to solve the puzzle, not how you sit there and wait for a shaft of inspiration to come from above. Extraordinary life. Stephen Sondheim.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
Dave, 37 years ago yesterday,
my goodness,
where were we? Do you remember this?
37 years ago
yesterday, West London.
Probably at the Bomboniera Cafe at the top of Carnaby Street, sitting there talking
rubbish. In the smash, it's lunch break. Yeah.
It's lunch break. With Neil Tennant having apple pie and custard. Fog of cigarette smoke. Hissing steam from the tea urn. Go but on, carry
our
on.
Our ad where, man, Rob we Sop. Rob's ordering a rare steak. Saying, good vet could have that back up on its feet in 10 minutes. No, we were at Psalm West Studios, weren't we? West London. It was Band-Aid. Recording a Band-Aid. I'm trying to remember now what happened. I can remember we got a call saying that Bob Geldof was assembling various musicians and they were going to make a single. We didn't know much about it, really. You were doing a little clip for Whistle Test. I was writing
about Mike Hamilton and Whistle Test said, I want you to go down there, Bob Geldof. And everybody raised their eyebrows. Bob Geldof? Because at that point, you know, they were deader than a dead thing.
They were, I know.
Absolutely. Bob Geldof is making a charity record. And we just thought, this is not going to happen at all. But anyway, I'd like you to go down there with the film crew. It was a Sunday morning, wasn't it? Sunday morning was Sunday morning.
The old church.
Yes, the old former Island Basing Street Studios, which had been taken over probably by Trevor Horn at that point, hadn't it?
Trevor Horn studio.
Yeah, his place. And so I turned up and you turned up, and our expectations were somewhat low, weren't they, really?
But I remember being amazed by the level of celebrity there, and also amazed by the combination, the age difference between some of them, which seemed at the time so huge. I remember the first people I met were Rick Parfitt, who was 36 at the time, Francis Rossi was 35, Phil Collins was 33, and they seemed like knackered, superannuated.
That was
old
the older generation
compared to Bananarama, Duran Duran, Paul Weller, etc., who were all about 26, which, of course, seems absolutely absurd now. Actually, Geldof himself was 33 and Sting was 33, but somehow they were new wave and they didn't quite count as the old guard. But there was another interesting thing about it, was that back then, pop music was divided up into different camps. Now it's one big happy family, isn't it? Everybody gets on, everybody's friendly towards each other. But then it was so huge and there was room for everybody and everyone was making hay. And they all took pot shots at each other, didn't they? Everyone had a go at each other. You know, Spandau Ballet and Duran used to tear strips off each other. Everybody hated you too. Everybody loathed Phil Collins and Status Quo. It was so odd to see them all together. Paul Weller particularly was always sounding off about everybody because he thought he was more principled and authentic and real than a lot of the other acts. You know, like, I remember him saying to me he said, everyone's ignoring me. No one's talking to me. And I don't blame them, you know. I can remember Gary Kemp saying loudly that it was a ploy by Island Records to get every pop star except Frankie Goes to Hollywood into one room and blow the place up. But it was really rather thrilling, wasn't it? Don't you think? That number of people together and just watching them going in and having to record, and how much you felt for people doing those individual lines. Because, you know, they all had to go and record with all their peers watching, didn't they? Paul Young and Bono, Tony Hadley and Boy George and everybody. A bit like stepping up to take a penalty. So a lot of tension.
It must be extraordinary for those people who are in it, because they must be able to just look back at it as the day in their lives, mustn't they? You know what I mean? You know, even if you were as big as Boy George, never got any bigger than that. You know, that was the moment of their maximum celebrity.
God, I can remember Did anybody
in that lineup get bigger afterwards?
Probably not, actually.
There you go.
No, probably not. I mean, it was. I remember Boy George being told at, you know, 9 a.m. our time to get over. He was in America and getting on the Concorde. Seemed so glamorous at the time, and arriving at 6 o'clock in the evening with his crimson hair and swanning in, seeing Marilyn there and going, hello, Doris. And Marilyn, Marilyn certainly didn't get bigger. Marilyn wasn't invited, if I remember rightly. He just managed to sneak in. You know, why would he? If you didn't invite Frankie Goes to Hollywood, but you did invite Marilyn, that wouldn't make any sense at all. He snuck in there and got into all the pictures and added a vocal, you know. But no, I think probably peak moment for all of them.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
So, Mark, you've got something you want to say about Get Back that you haven't said already.
Well, no, it's just it's interesting seeing the odd review that suggests that it's not that it matters. I mean, I don't know how influential reviews are anymore, but the odd review suggesting that it's quite hard work. Well, of course it's hard work. If you hadn't sat down and thought, am I the kind of person that wants to watch 8 hours of the Beatles? You know what I mean? and made a decision. If you think, oh, that might be quite interesting, would you watch an 8-hour film about anything that you're mildly interested in? Probably not. I mean, the point is that, yes, there are inordinate amounts of kind of waffle and frippery. And in the middle of that, you get amazing moments. I mean, admittedly, I still haven't seen the whole thing, but I mean, they do sound like there's some fantastic bits. The Magic Alex stuff sounds absolutely wonderful. There's a bit where Lennon apparently takes delivery of a ridiculous bass guitar with a revolving double-sided neck. I'd love to see that. And where Lennon and his white Rolls Royce with a TV aerial on the top gets a parking ticket. All that stuff sounds brilliant. But I mean, you know, if you're having to wade through, you think you're wading through stuff to pick those moments out, then you're probably not the kind of person who should be watching in the first place. My feeling is, they probably should have done two versions. You know, an 8-hour version, because it would be absolutely lamentable and morally wrong not to include as much of this unique and historic footage as possible, if it exists. And therefore, they should, for completists and complete addicts like us, have done an 8-hour version, which we will all see and we will all really enjoy. And we will approach knowing precisely what we're getting into. And then maybe done a kind of 2-hour edit for cinemas for the broader public who've just got a passing interest in the Beatles. I don't know. It's, I mean, Mark Lewisohn's book comes out in two versions, isn't it? The first volume in the trilogy. You know, there's a 900...
The airport paperback.
Yes, the airport paperback. The flick-through version.
The pocket book.
960 yes. pages. And then there's a 1,728-page monster edition if you want the unedited version. Well, if you're the kind of person who decided you do, you buy it. Makes complete sense.
Okay.
So while we're being controversial, have you seen the story about the Brit Awards combining the male and female categories?
Oh yeah,
in one. Because I read the story here on the BBC website. It says Dua Lipa and Jay Huss will go down in history as the last stars to win Best Female and Male at the Brit Awards. I thought that's quite funny. There's two names like Dua Lipa and Jay Huss because there's no clue in either of those names. As to the sex of either of the people, yeah. You know, so they could be male, could be female. Artists like Sam Smith and Will Young had previously called for the change, saying the current system excludes non-binary artists. And so, you know, it just struck me as absolutely strange because surely you're going to reduce the number of potential winners, aren't you? Because... It struck me that all attempts to make prizes, particularly show business prizes, more fair are by definition doomed because there is something about show business prizes that works because it's not fair. If you want to prove who's the most popular, it's quite simple. You just add up all the sales figures at the end of the year and it's Adele or whatever it is. You know, that's quite simple. And, you know, people are quite happy to be beneficiaries of that unfairness, but to get
complain
very,
loudly about
very
it
arsy if they're left out.
It's completely subjective. It's like Great British Bake Off.
Of course it is. That's what fair. We like about it. And all these moves. I see the Turner Prize is now dominated by collectives, isn't it? You know, which must make the people who invented the Turner Prize, which is obviously the contemporary art prize, must make them want to tear their hair out. Because when they invented it, however many years ago it was, it's pretty much like the Booker Prize for fiction. What they wanted to do was say, okay, out of this massive area with loads and loads of names, we pluck one. We pluck one, and that one becomes the beneficiary of the public spotlight, and everybody knows who they are. And the same thing applies with the book or whatever. It doesn't work if it's collectives.
No, it doesn't.
And if it's shared between three collectives,
no.
You've lost that impact.
It doesn't have that completely. Sense of personality.
Absolutely, because his personality is what it's all about. It's a, you know, it's like, you know, everybody works in some business where they go along once a year to the Grosvenor House or God knows what, or the NEC, and people give out awards for the, you know, most competitive, most innovative plumber in the West Midlands in 2021 or whatever it is. It's subjective. Of course it is. that's what we like about it, you know. So trying to make it somehow more fair, more equal, just sort of doesn't work.
Well, and it's so, partly Sam Smith driving it, isn't it? Because Sam Smith is kind of non-binary.
Well, that's what he said.
And identifies as they, them, and therefore doesn't feel that they, you know, fit into either category or whatever. But I would have thought you ultimately finish up with less awards, which is a bad thing.
This is it. Surely.
Yeah.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink and it's like being in the pub.
Okay, so this week we had the comeback of Word of Your Ears, the live event, which we did at a small venue, West Hampstead Arts Club, with Peter Doggett, who's written a book about sex in the 1960s, and John Ilsley of Dire Straits, written a memoir of his time with Dire Straits. And later in the week, we spoke to Lenny Kaye, the great Lenny Kaye, the venerable rock critic, scenester, guitarist with Patti Smith since the year dot, whatever, about his new book, Lightning Strikes, which is about 10 places and times in rock history when everything changed. And it struck me those two have got something in common, or it made me think about similar things, Mark. We were talking to John Ilsley about, will Dire Straits ever get back together? And he said he thought it was unlikely, and he thought it was fine that they didn't get back together again, because they all got on with each other.
Yeah, he said the important thing to him was his friendship with Mark Knopfler, and he thought that might be endangered if they then got the group back together again. That was far more important than him than going back on the road, which I thought was a really interesting point, actually.
I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, really touching. And it struck me, you were going to say Lenny Kaye and Patti Smith clearly
Lenny
still
Kaye.
Adore each other, don't they?
I mean, the thing about Lenny Kaye, and please do go and watch that. You know, it's on YouTube now. Because he is a sweetheart. He just
absolutely
is
an adorable guy.
Absolute sweetheart. And you can't help thinking that it's because he's a sweetheart that that whole thing has stayed together for as long as it has, which is since 1974, 75 or whatever.
Yeah.
Been some kind of Patti Smith group. And he's pretty much, I think he's probably the glue. And I think a lot of the glue there is his personality as much as anything else.
You know? Yeah, completely. He reminded me a little bit of Dave Stewart, actually. Those people who are never completely in the spotlight. They're never in the front line. And therefore, nobody ever feels any sense of competition. And they're really, really sweet-natured and collaborative and cooperative and really interested in music and have huge record collections. And they're not a competition to anybody. And therefore, they just develop an enormous number of friends. Incredible guy, really, really sweet, and lovely. What he was saying about his record collection—that he divides up his record collection into food groups, doesn't he?
The major food groups.
Yeah, one section called Wacko. He just decides to put in really insane stuff. It's amazing. But the
I always think of him as the kind of ultimate record collector, because he was. I was looking. He did the compilation album Nuggets, which came out in 1972. Which is the very beautifully packaged and very lovingly put together compilation of kind of garage rock, I suppose, psychedelic garage rock from America in the 60s. And I think I said to him during this chat, and I was saying it flippantly, but actually I think it's probably true, he kind of invented retro with that album, really. And the whole world of kind of mojo and uncut, and all that stuff where you go back and you take kind of, you know, chin-stroking interest in cheap entertainment from years earlier, all comes out of Len Kaye and Nuggets. And so he's a man who's been collecting records since probably the 50s, whatever. He always wanted, what did he say? He always wanted to be the tenor in a doo-wop group.
Yes.
That's how far back he goes.
You know? I know. And that's so interesting that doo-wop was one of the things he was listening to, wasn't it? In fact, doo-wop, interestingly, was the thing he wrote an article about for a New York paper that Patti Smith read and got in touch with him when he worked at a record shop and said, I want to meet you because I love doo-wop too. And that was the kind of connection between the two of them. Frank Zappa.
And also, he also goes back far enough that he was talking about having seen the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. And he'd probably be about 17, I think, at the time. And he says he'd just learned a load of chords to play in a folk group, hadn't he?
Because
he was into the later end of the kind of Peter, Paul and Mary Kingston trio boom and so forth. And suddenly the Beatles came along, oh, throw away the folk guitar. you know, go electric overnight. Really, really interesting person. And,
can I read just two or three lines out of the book? Here's a little bit where you first meet him in his book, which is called Lightning Striking, and he's 12 years old. This just gives you an idea of how connected with pop culture he is and with music. He says, describes a picture that he has of himself, age 12 in Brooklyn. He says, my sleeves are rolled up on my short-sleeved shirt. My hair is parted on the left side, combed to the right, held in slope by Wild Root Cream Oil. And I'm wearing a pair of ripple-soled shoes. There's a keychain looped along my right leg and into my front pocket, a stylistic remnant of the Zoot Suit era. Think, imagine being that aware of all that pop culture, at the age of 12. It's a fantastic book, I think. But so, John Ilsley, John Ilsley, it struck me that I always thought that Gary Tallent of the E Street Band had the greatest job in the world. You know, you're on there, no real responsibility, playing some bass parts, none of them particularly demanding. You're not required to do any kind of showcase. There's no point in the evening when the spotlight's on you. I don't think you even sing any backing vocals. John Ilsley has had exactly the same gig. That wonderful sense of playing to these huge, huge stadiums. And at one point he said they played 248 gigs. These are stadium gigs in 1 year in 23 different countries. So he's doing all right for a living, you know. No backing vocals, not required to write any songs, not required really to even do any press or do any of the promotion. Just the guy in the band, just, you know, there and thoroughly enjoy. I thought, what an amazing life that would have been. Don't you think?
Sensation. Oh, yeah, definitely.
What a gig.
Anyway, to climax on a chat with Lenny Kaye, I was sitting in front of my big rack of records, which is obviously nothing like as big as a rack of records as Lenny Kaye will have. And he said, well, just reach around, pick one out, and we'll see what it is. And so if you want to see what it is, you've got to go and look at the clip online. And if you wanted to see what these things are, you know, earlier than anybody else, you can, you can make sure to support us on Patreon, which we very much appreciate. If you go to patreon.com, word in your ear, there are full details of how you can do that.
The Word Podcast. Clearly, there is no plan.
Okay, any other business? And we're joined once again by Alex Gold. And Alex has triggered the next item, which is the return of the Stack Wardy game. Because last week we were bemoaning the fact of the ridiculous proliferation of mad categories in record shops that exist purely to bamboozle innocent members of the public. And Alex was contributing to this. And he says, for instance, there's spatula core. And Mark and I went, yeah. And then afterwards, I thought, spatula core. He just made that up. I thought, that's a good reason for the return of the Sackbody game. So, ladies and gentlemen, here we go. Alex Gold is going to give us, five or something like that?
Yeah. Five musical genres, four of which are real and one is fictitious. Is that right?
Okay. That's precisely it. And here they are. So your five musical genres are Simpson Wave.
Oh, God. Carry on. Go on.
Pirate Metal. Squee. Spelt SKW, three E's. Boggle. And Witch House. As in pointy hat and broom.
Witch House. I think I've heard of pirate metal. I don't know, I may be wrong. Because there was, what was one? Simpson Corner.
Simpson Wave.
Simpson Wave. That sounds suspicious to me. Simpson Wave, Squee. Squee seems possible too.
Boggle. All right, shall I go first?
Go on.
I think Boggle is the ringer.
Okay.
I think it's Simpson Wave, but go on.
Right, well, I can tell you right now that the ringer is, drum roll, Boggle.
Okay.
It is Boggle. Boggle, in my head, is a cousin of Gabba with bass frequencies so drastic and deep that it actually messes with the synapses in the brain and confuses people. Yet to be invented, but I've got a whole brief written out for the genre. So, all the others are absolutely genuine. So, Simpson Wave apparently emerged in 2016 and combined sampled audio and video from The Simpsons with an obsession with 1990s internet aesthetics, whatever that is.
Yeah.
Astonishing. Pirate metal is my new favourite genre, even though I haven't heard a note of it. Basically, what it is, it's sea shanties sung like shrieks in a metal style.
Good. This is good.
But accompanied by folk instruments.
Yeah, so yeah.
You've got a screamer accompanied by a concertina or something like that. Squee is a Swedish genre.
How are you spelling squee again? That's brilliant.
S K W E E E.
Of course it is.
And it's predominantly instrumental, and it sort of merges synth and bass line with funk and soul rhythms. And the name comes from the idea of sort of squeezing out the grooviest possible sound. And Witch House is it's not as cool as it sounds, actually. Witch House is basically it's chopped songs that incorporate goth and shoegaze and hip hop and industrial.
How sad it is that I've missed that, Mark.
Yeah, I still got a hole in my life.
I feel I ought to get into Witch House. Okay, Mark, have you got a contribution?
I have five genres, one of which is fictitious, and they are chiptune. Chiptune, power stomp, lento violento, mathcore, and Sawyerbilly. So there we are.
What's the last one? Sawyerbilly.
Sawyerbilly. Yep. So they are. I'll give them to you again. They are power stomp, chiptune, lento violento, mathcore, and Sawyerbilly. Spot the ringer.
Alex, are you going to choose the ringer, Alex?
I'm pretty sure mathcore is a genuine genre. If I was a betting man, I really want to believe Sawyerbilly is a real thing and become part of that movement. I will go for, I reckon chiptune's a ringer, you know.
Okay.
I'm going to go for Sawyerbilly. All right, Mark.
I must admit, I thought it was blatantly obvious that it was Sawyerbilly. Sawyerbilly is made up. For me, in my head, it's a drape jacketed rock and roll revival from a Bristol-based community of vegan musicians. And among the stars of the groups there are Zupa Toscana, Tofu Fighters, and the Lasker Soup Dragons.
Very good.
But no, it's completely made up. No, the real ones are chiptune, which is an 8-bit music style of synthesized electronic music, etc. I Fight Dragons and Starship Amazing. Power Stomp is a kind of British hardcore coined by DJ Kurt in 2007. Lento Violento is slowed down Italian techno from 2010, which is real. And Mathcore in the 1990s. Bands in the genre emphasize complex and fluctuant rhythms through the use of irregular time signatures, polymeters, syncopations, and tempo change. So, there you go. You rumble me. It was a bit obvious. Sawyerbilly. I like the idea of Sawyerbilly.
Question. So that's the return of the Stagwaddy game. Nice to see. Questions from the Massive. Poppy's from a Tray says, interested in your thoughts on Alan Hull of Lindisfarne and his place in the list of great English songwriters after seeing the BBC Four documentary last night, which you did, Mark Ellen.
I did see it. I'd forgotten how fantastic he was. He's really nice. All the old Geordie community, Jimmy Nail and Sting, Dave Stewart, and also actually Peter Gabriel was on there because, of course, the Charisma tour when they all went on a package tour together. And they were all, making the point that he was up there in the kind of great pantheon of English songwriters alongside Ray Davies. I've forgotten how good he was. He's fantastic, actually. It's an amazing story, an incredible story. And
was he? Because he's no longer with us, is he?
No, he's not.
He became a Labour councillor, didn't he?
I think he did. I should have looked him up. I think he did.
He was on the council for in middle age. Yes, useful member of society in all respects.
Absolutely,
I think it's fair to say. Okay, Harp and a Monkey says, any more obvious examples of musicians doing a Billy Preston? No doubt in the light of Get Back. that is brought into a tight pre-existing unit, reinvigorating them and saving them, even if only temporarily, from themselves. Good question. Good I'd question. Suggest, any nominations? Go on, yeah, Alex.
I'd nominate Craig Gannon joining the Smiths.
That's a good thought. Because they became a five-piece at the end, didn't they?
They did, and they imploded not long after, I don't think.
In fact, I think when they were on Whistle Test, right at the end, I think they were a five-piece then. Because, you know, there was a lot of friction, wasn't there? And they just, like Billy Preston, did someone in there to make sure everyone was on their best behaviour. I don't know. In fact,
I think Johnny Marr left and Craig Gannon, the Craig Gannon four-piece were a thing for a little bit, and then they imploded. So, but yeah.
I've got a nomination from slightly further back. Dave Swarbrick joining Fairport Convention kept Fairport Convention going. You know, because had he not joined, you know, Sandy Denny would have gone, Richard Thompson would have gone, and they would probably have fallen apart at that stage. Whereas Dave Swarbrick came in there and was slightly different.
Yeah, that's a good
one. And was a new kind of front man. So he did that job. So it's an interesting question, and people may well have other answers, and that's fine. And Gareth says, any great albums or songs that reflect the drudgery of office life? When it's tried, usually by the great Divine Comedy, they show that musicians don't really understand the daily routine of most of their audiences, which is, you know, it's an interesting question. And somebody responded, these are all on Twitter, somebody responded on Twitter that obviously Fountains of Wayne, with songs like Bright Future in Sales and Little Red Light.
But that's a really good example of that, because that's not a song about doing the job. It's a song about a guy being so hungover, isn't it, that he's not able to do his presentation. So it didn't imply that they knew much about the work world that he was meant to exist in. But
I suppose also the world of work has changed so much in the last 20, 30 years, hasn't it? That the older, you know, people used to write songs about working, but it was physical work, wasn't it? That they wrote about sawing in a pick or working on the highway, all that kind of stuff.
Chain gang.
Whereas nowadays people are working in call centers or, you know, things of that nature, which, you know, nobody can find a way to kind of romanticize. But I suppose you have the old classics, the old staples like Friday on My Mind by the Easy Beats is obviously, you know, the great song about, you know, the 5-day grind and
looking
so forth.
Forward to the weekend. Yeah.
They're looking forward to the weekend. That's what those songs tend to be about. Brian Stevens says, what was the first use of the F word in popular song?
Well, that's a good question.
I mean, I don't know the answer, but I can tell you the first time I came across it in the sense of it was on a normally released record that I actually bought, and that was Al Stewart's Love Chronicles.
Oh, yes.
Which must have been, what, 67 or 68? I can't remember.
It was.
And that, I do recommend...
It's less about the F word and more about making love.
Well, if you want a thumping good laugh, actually, and I like quite like Al Stewart, but, you know, go and listen to Love Chronicles, because he had an album called Love Chronicles. And the whole second side of Love Chronicles was taken up by one song, which is basically about all his girlfriends.
All the women he slept with. It's just bragging, basically, isn't it?
It is. And we used to sit there and listen to them. Oh, God, she sounds nice. Ooh, she sounds like a nightmare. Verse 5.
Yeah,
oh, dear.
Yeah.
You dodged a bullet there. But at the final, as he got towards the end, you know, he matured. and in this verse near the end, he says, grew to be less like fucking and more like making love. We always used to nod sagely.
Yeah. Oh, we did too. Having absolutely no idea what he's talking about. I know. Working Class Hero was the one that made the most... The most waves, wasn't it? But that was a lot later. That was, you know, when was that? Was 70, 71? I can't remember.
70. So, yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be, it's not that much later, I suppose. Darren Leithley says, what's left in the Beatles' well other than Carnival of Light? Nothing, surely.
Can't be anything.
There can't be anything. Can't be anything at all. So those are your questions, which we're grateful for. Alex, anything to add? We got new Patreon supporters whose names you'd like to list.
Yes, we have. I'd like to welcome aboard Peter Joslin.
Good man.
Hello, Peter. Well, I'm very sorry. I haven't got a ship's whistle. I've been threatening for 2 years now to announce the arrival of new patrons with a bosun's whistle and haven't been able to actually put my hands on one yet, but I will do at some stage. Carry on.
Or a deafening applause button you can just press. It's just a burst of applause.
Carry on.
Jerry Hillman.
Thank you,
Hello, Jerry.
Mino Erasmo Russo.
Very good. Nino. Excellent.
Toby Mitchell.
Hello, Toby.
Very nice to see you.
Kevin Ray.
Hello, Kevin, also.
Mark Lamming.
Mark Lamming.
Nicole Barker.
Nicole Barker.
Niall Taylor.
Come on, they're flooding him. Go on.
David Merriweather.
David, what a fine name, David Merriweather.
Sounds like something from Rivendell, doesn't it?
It does. And these are annual patrons. Next, of course, if you subscribe annually, you get a 15% discount, which is, of course, not to be sniffed at. Paul Kent.
Nice. Hello, Paul.
Philip
so we were
Davenport.
Seeing Paul on the occasion of his... we were seeing these people on the occasion of their birthdays, weren't we?
Actually, no, that will be the Access All Areas patrons.
All right, okay, yes. Sorry. All right, fine. Okay, carry on.
Philip Davenport.
Yep, very good.
Hello, Philip.
Jonathan Beggs.
Hello, Jonathan.
Bill Ambrose.
Hello, Bill. Have you come far?
Direct from the Archers. He's not heard that before.
And Paul Bernays.
Paul Bernays, I do like your sauce. lovely to have them all aboard. The good ship word in your ear. And if you'd like to join them, as we say, go to patreon.com word in your ear. And there will be more fun going forward.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.